Today at Reader's Corner, Christian Carl, author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century.
The 1970s, that was the decade when the whole notion of globalization first began to play a role in international discourse. And that was precisely because communications had advanced dramatically. Deng Xiaoping and Margaret Thatcher together were responsible for the amazing revival of market economics in the world. As I watch the events in Syria and Lebanon and negotiations about Iran's nuclear weapons, you know, I can't help but think it's all about 1979.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Pick up a newspaper or turn on the radio, and it's likely you'll learn about the latest fluctuation in world financial markets or about a protest or uprising tied in some way to religion. Christian Carl contends that these two forces, market capitalism and faith-inspired politics, especially politicized Islam, have their roots in the year 1979. In his recent book, Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century, Mr. Carl writes that more than any other year in the latter half of the 20th century, 1979 heralded the economic, political, and religious realities that define our world today. Mr. Carl focuses on five seemingly disparate personalities and events to make his case. These include John Paul II's visit to Poland, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, sweeping market reforms in China and Britain, and the rise of Afghanistan's Islamist resistance movement. Christian Carl is a contributing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine and a senior fellow at the Legatum Institute, a nonpartisan public policy think tank. He also is a senior fellow at the Center for International Studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. Mr. Carl served as head of Newsweek's Tokyo and Moscow bureaus and Moscow bureau chief for U.S. News and World Report. He was a member of a Newsweek reporting team that won a 2004 National Magazine Award for reporting from Iraq. In his journalistic career, he has reported from 37 countries. Mr. Carl joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. for this interview. Christian Carl, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, Bob. Thanks for inviting me.
One of the things about your book that really struck me was in the epilogue, when you were talking about your trip to the sister cities of Shenzhen and Hong Kong, China, you mentioned turning a corner, and there was a remarkable sight. Deng Xiaoping and Margaret Thatcher having a chat, two life-size wax figures. And give us an idea, maybe this will get us into this discussion, of what's going on there. What was the Chinese intention of putting these two folks together in a statue? And secondly, there appears to be a little deeper meaning, as far as your book is concerned anyway.
Oh, well, thank you so much for bringing that up, Bob. That's actually a fantastic place to start. Yes, I was in Shenzhen, which is, of course, this enormous city where pretty much all of our high tech is now made, at least in part. And Shenzhen traces its birth back to 1979. That's really when it became the city that it is today, which is really not that long ago when you consider that it now has the population of New York City. And as for the encounter of Thatcher and Deng Xiaoping, China's paramount leader starting in the end of the 70s, the reason why those two wax statues were there was because the two leaders met in the 1980s to discuss the handover of Hong Kong, which, as you'll recall, was a British colony right up through the 1980s, and they had to negotiate the handover agreement under which Hong Kong then reverted to Chinese administration. That's why these two wax figures were there. But I saw a deeper significance in this because, of course, Deng Xiaoping and Margaret Thatcher, I think together were responsible for the amazing revival of market economics in the world that we saw starting in 1979. Thatcher, of course, dismantled the social democratic system in Britain where, for example, the state owned a lot of the key industries and regulated prices down to an unbelievably detailed level. And Deng Xiaoping, as the main successor to Mao Zedong in China, implemented these far-reaching market reforms that have turned China into the market powerhouse that it is today. So when I saw those two wax figures together in that little museum in Shenzhen, I couldn't help marveling over image that they brought to mind.
And this would be a lot more understandable, these linkages and these connections, if this were 2010 and we were in the middle of the social media revolution and we were talking about the Arab Spring, because we know that in those particular cases, students and young people in Tunisia were passing on their problems and complaints and challenges to the regime over to Egypt. And before you know it, it spreads like wildfire. But back in 1979, we didn't have all that going for us. So help us understand how these linkages occurred. I think at one point you said that in the case of Deng Xiaoping, he actually came back to China after a visit to America, where he came up with some of his market reform agenda.
That's exactly right. In fact, I think even more important for some of Deng Xiaoping's market reforms were his visits in 1978 to Japan and Singapore, which are, of course, both East Asian countries that had, after World War II, staged these extraordinary economic revivals by relying on a specifically East Asian form of capitalism. And those were tremendously inspiring experiences to Deng Xiaoping, especially Singapore, because Singapore was a very good example for him of how you could implement market reforms under a very authoritarian one-party system, which was what they had in Singapore, of course. And so that really confirmed for him that there was a Chinese version of market reform that he could implement without endangering the primacy of the Communist Party. And then in early 1979, the year that I discuss in my book, he took this trip to the United States, which really did play an incredibly important role in China's course for the next couple of decades. When he was in America, he visited Coca-Cola, he visited Ford, he visited NASA's headquarters in Houston, and he was deeply impressed by both the vitality of the market economy in the United States and also the role of information technology, which was something where China was incredibly far behind at that time. Mm-hmm. So I think together all of these travels had an absolutely vital impact on Deng's thinking.
Now, maybe you could call this moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, but you have to tell us the story that you relate in your book when Deng Xiaoping meets up with the actress Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that one up, Bob. Yes, well, of course, while Deng Xiaoping was in the United States, his visit was a very big deal. You know, no Chinese communist leader had visited the United States in, I think, ever. And this was the moment when the United States and the People's Republic of China finally normalized diplomatic relations, many years after Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong and Henry Kissinger had initiated that process. So they had a big state dinner for Deng Xiaoping in the White House, and they sat him next to the actress Shirley MacLaine, who had recently been to China at the height of the Cultural Revolution. And, of course, she was quite a good 1970s leftist liberal, and she thought the Cultural Revolution was great, and she told Deng Xiaoping with great enthusiasm how she had run into this professor who was working on a collective farm way out in the countryside, and Shirley MacLaine had asked him, wow, how do you feel about being sent out here by the Communist Party way out in the middle of nowhere? And the professor, of course, had told her how great it was and how wise the Communist Party was. And she told Deng Xiaoping about this incident with great enthusiasm as an example of how great things were in China. And Deng Xiaoping, of course, was a very unsentimental character and who had himself been sent to the countryside during Mao's Cultural Revolution, looked at her and he said, that professor was lying. How could you believe that crap? You know, professors should be teaching at universities. They shouldn't be plowing fields. And I think that's a great example of what a really very practically minded fellow he was.
Mm-hmm. Well, your discussion of the Islamic takeover in Iran by the followers of Ayatollah Khomeini in the early 1979 was perhaps the most revolutionary of all of the events you talk about. And maybe you can help us understand that, especially like where was the world on this? What was our reaction? And then here we are in 2013, and the Secretary of State is having all kinds of very serious discussions on the nuclear arms issue and ways to normalize relations to some extent between Iran and the United States. So it's like back to the future.
Well, there you go. I think that's exactly the way to put it. As I watch the events in Syria and Lebanon and the nuclear negotiations about Iran's nuclear weapons, you know, I can't help but think it's all about 1979. Ayatollah Khomeini was a very, very shrewd politician. He cooked up an amazing blend of traditional Islam and modern 20th century revolutionary thinking. People often say, oh, you know, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, it was a return to the Middle Ages. They really couldn't be more wrong when they say that, because the important thing about the revolution in Iran was precisely that it combined the notions of Islam and revolution, in some cases in very, very innovative ways. And it unleashed this self-awareness among the Shiites in the Middle East that is still very, very important today. And we see that playing a huge role in the civil war in Syria, where Iran is allied with the regime there. And we see that in Iran's support for other Shiite movements around the Middle East. So the things that Ayatollah Khomeini did in 1979 continue to resonate down to the present day in very, very immediate and practical ways. At the time, in fact, this combination of Islam and revolutionary thinking was so unique that we really had no way of conceptualizing it. Nowadays, we just take this for granted. You know, we take jihadists and their revolutionary thinking as just part of the background noise. But in 1979, it was so unusual, people really didn't know what to make of it. And my favorite example for this is a lot of people at the time compared Ayatollah Khomeini with Gandhi, of all people. Because, you know, Gandhi was a religious leader in India who promoted, an anti-colonial struggle. That shows you how people were groping around for models to understand what was happening in Iran. It was so unique and distinct, and people really didn't know what to make of it.
The Shah had long enjoyed the support of the United States, despite the corruption and the suppression of dissent. When you look at it today, and especially, I suppose, among younger Iranians who may have a slightly different historical perspective, to what extent does the historical support of the Shah affect Iranian-U.S. relations today?
Well, it still has an enormous effect on U.S.-Iranian relations because, for example, you know, the Iranian hostage crisis. Ayatollah Khomeini approved the seizure of the American hostages in the embassy a few days after the students had stormed the U.S. embassy. And the reason he approved that and basically gave state sanction to the takeover of the U.S. embassy was precisely because President Jimmy Carter had allowed the Shah into the United States for medical treatment. The Shah, deposed and humiliated, at this point was suffering from rather severe cancer, and a number of his friends in the United States prevailed upon President Carter to allow the Shah into the U.S. for medical treatment. And when he did that, it inflamed nationalist and religious sentiments in Iran to really an extraordinary degree and gave Khomeini the opportunity to capitalize on this anti-American feeling with effects, again, which are still felt to the present day. You know, today the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, who are the self-appointed guardians of the revolution, actually have their headquarters, the Al-Quds Force, which basically engineers a lot of Iranian mischief around the Middle East today, actually has its headquarters in the building of the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran. And, you know, whenever the Iranian regime gets into trouble, whenever the discontent of citizens, which is quite considerable, becomes a little hard to manage, all the regime there has to do is press the anti-America button and invoke the crimes of the Shah, who was, of course, a very close friend of the United States for his entire time in office. And they can just kind of press those buttons and easily manipulate public opinion in Iran. So, again, our longtime friendship with the Shah is still very much an issue in politics, in relations between Iran and the United States today.
You're listening to Christian Carl. He's the author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. You've said that your experience as a journalist in Afghanistan after 9/11 triggered the train of thought that led to this book. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I was in Afghanistan right after 9/11, reporting for Newsweek. And shortly after Kabul was liberated from the Taliban, I was there in Kabul, and I was roaming around doing my reporting. And one of the things that struck me about Kabul right after the Taliban had left was how this city really was a kind of 1970s time capsule. Most of the buildings had been built in the 1970s. There were still 1970s cars around. When the bookstore that I visited reopened after the Taliban, they began displaying, as they were unable to do under Taliban rule, a lot of their books and pictures and postcards from the 1970s. And what all of this brought home was how Afghanistan in the 1970s was a place that was developing quite well. People forget, but in the late 60s, 1970s, Afghanistan was almost kind of like Bali is today. It was this exotic vacation destination for people. And it was perfectly safe. There was no civil strife to any significant degree. It was a happening kind of place. Afghanistan in the 70s was going places. And then, right at the end of the 1970s, something happened. The Afghan Communist Party seized power. They got into big trouble. There was a rebellion against them. And the Soviet Union invaded the country to shore up communist rule there. And in some ways, ever since that moment, Christmas 1979, history in Afghanistan has been running in reverse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was struck by that at the time. I thought, wow, you know, how many countries have hit a wall in this way? How many countries have encountered such dramatic change as Afghanistan did in 1978, 1979? And I thought for a while about writing about that. And then as I traveled to other places such as Iraq and China, I began to realize that Afghanistan wasn't the only place that experienced this kind of dramatic, game-changing effect in 1970. And there were a bunch of other places as well. And as I started to connect the dots, I realized there was a very interesting story there.
And it was the Mujahideen that really takes off against the Soviets. But I think one of the points you make is that it's not necessarily an anti-Soviet thing. It may be broader than that.
I think it was broader, Bob. I think you're absolutely right. Throughout the 1970s in Afghanistan, the Communist Party there was a very dominant political force, and the Islamists were actually not so strong. But the two groups battled each other a lot, and they had a lot of debates, especially at the universities in Afghanistan. And as time went on, the Islamists in Afghanistan learned a lot from the Communists, just as the Islamists in Iran learned a lot from the Communists. They learned a lot of things about organization, about how to organize modern political parties, about how to act in an ideological way. They learned how to take their religion and make it an ideology. And again, the things that they learned and that they implemented are still very, very much part of the mix in that war that we continue to fight in Afghanistan today. One of the forces that we're fighting in Afghanistan is the force of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was one of the main Mujahideen leaders in Afghanistan in 1979. And it's very striking in the early stages of the revolt against the Red Army in Afghanistan to see how these new revolutionary Islamist parties take over and take the lead from the traditional Islamic leaders in Afghanistan, who gradually fade into the background. You know, the Taliban is a creation of the 1990s. We tend to think of them as this very, very traditional, backward-looking force, but they didn't exist before the middle of the 1990s. And they exist very much because of the help of Pakistan, which helped to form them into the force that they are. So it's very important to look at recent history, like the history that I cover in my book, to understand where these groups come from and how modern and contemporary these ideas really are.
And you connect the Mujahideen's struggle to the burgeoning moments of the Solidarity movement in Poland, which was sparked by John Paul II. What's the connection there?
Well, the connection is surprisingly intimate, Bob. As I tell in my book, in 1979, John Paul II, the newly elected Polish pope, paid his first visit to his home country as pope, and he inspired this really very powerful campaign of peaceful resistance to Soviet rule in Poland. The year after he visited Poland, saw the formation of the Solidarity Trade Union, which then in many ways leads directly to the revolts against communism in 1989, a decade later, and helped to trigger the fall of Soviet control of Eastern Europe. So that campaign of civil resistance that the Pope's visit inspired was a peaceful one. The campaign against Soviet intervention in Afghanistan was, of course, very much a violent one, a violent military struggle. But what the two things have in common is that they really tied down the Soviet Union and complicated life for Soviet leaders in very dramatic ways. And in fact, one of the reasons why the Soviet leadership pressured the Polish Communist Party to crack down against Solidarity in 1981 was because the Soviet Union was so beleaguered by its own involvement in Afghanistan. That involvement was consuming so many resources and so much money that the Soviet leadership knew they really couldn't afford to intervene in Poland themselves. They just didn't have the resources. They didn't have the capacity. So managing these two crises at opposite ends of the Soviet empire, the one in Poland, the one in Afghanistan, was just a little more than the Soviets could manage and really sapped their resources. And when Ronald Reagan came along and decided to really reaccelerate the arms race, it was really more than the Soviets could bear.
And John Paul intended his message of faith to be a challenge to communist authority. Was it necessarily then a challenge to the capitalistic, advocating capitalism?
Actually, people tend to forget, because John Paul II was so hard on communism, that he was actually quite suspicious of the market and by no means a big fan of untrammeled capitalism. He was quite a social activist. He wrote a lot about the role of labor and about the need to defend organized labor and working people. This is one of the reasons why the trade union, Solidarity, became such an important force in Polish life, because the Pope was fully behind the idea of an activist labor movement. And, you know, he gave some very famous speeches where he was very critical of Western-style capitalism and just kind of letting market forces play as they wanted. People tend to forget this about him, that he actually had quite a social activist side, as indeed many Catholic leaders have had. I think we see this very strongly today in Pope Francis. So that's a very interesting aspect of this whole thing people also tend to forget, I think.
You're listening to Christian Karl. He's the author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. Based on your book and on many of the reviews, I lumped together what I called the sweeping market-oriented reforms in China and Britain. Obviously, those are two very different countries. One is based in a democracy. One is not, even to this present day. And so help us with the Margaret Thatcher as counter-revolutionary. And again, if we have time, I hope to get to that point. You lump all of these folks into that category as counter-revolutionaries. But in Thatcher's case, it's a little different, obviously, than Deng Xiaoping.
Of course. They were absolutely reacting against very different things. Deng Xiaoping was reacting against Maoist, you know, radical communism and egalitarianism. Thatcher was reacting to the Labour Party-dominated consensus in Britain after World War II, which was very much what we might call a soft European social democratic consensus. In 1945, the Labour Party swept to victory in this epochal election and created a modern welfare state in Britain, which, as I described, also included state ownership of key industries and a lot of really intricate socialist micromanagement of the economy. And Thatcher was reacting very much to that, and she was very self-consciously a rebel against that post-war consensus. And she really started from her first day in office in ways that caught a lot of people off guard at the time. Again, a lot of people at the time didn't quite know what to make of her when she started on her program. But again, I think it's hard to argue with the fact that the changes she implemented still shape Britain and, I would argue, much of the world very dramatically even today.
And I think you mentioned that she had an impact on Ronald Reagan, which I don't think we think of often enough.
I think she had a huge impact on Ronald Reagan. Reagan was an instinctual politician. He was not dumb. He was a smart man. But many of his views were very, very much kind of gut views, as indeed was the case with Thatcher. But Thatcher also had a much more intellectual approach to these issues than he did. She read a lot. She loved to argue. She loved to debate. She knew her opponents very, very well. And I think that in many ways she kind of stiffened his spine when it came to the issue of market reforms around the world.
So when it comes to the linkages and the connections, how can you explain, or maybe you can't, the extent to which, going back to my very first observation about the social media role that was played out in Arab Spring, was that working here? Were these folks watching one another? Were these folks acutely aware of what was going on across the world? And therefore, I mean, we already talked about the fact that Deng clearly was influenced by some of his travels to the Pacific Rim in the United States. But how about the rest of it?
It's absolutely true, Bob, that there there was a lot of informational exchange at the time, and we were very obsessed with social media today. But in the 1970s, that was the decade when the whole notion of globalization first began to play a role in international discourse. And that was precisely because global trade was skyrocketing, and also communications had advanced dramatically since any other time in human history. You know, satellite communications had come down in cost to the point where information was flowing around the world very rapidly. The end of the 1970s was also the period when the revolution in personal computing was coming about. As I mentioned in my book, one very powerful technology at the time that we tend to forget was the spread of the cassette tape, which was something that affected politics in Iran and Poland and China very, very dramatically. We tend to forget about how potent relatively simple technologies like that could be. But the main thing is this global revolution in telecommunications. Islamists, for example, all over the Islamic world were sharing texts and books and information in ways that only really became apparent to the West much later on. There was a huge amount of information sharing going on. We're very fixated on the internet today, but we tend to forget how dramatically the communications revolution affected life even before the internet came along.
The benefit of hindsight enables us to look back and select 1979 as a pivotal year. And by the way, I understand the fact that you're the one that did this, and I haven't read anyone else coming up with this particular thesis. I guess I have a couple of questions. Historians in 2013, looking back on the years since then, or maybe it's even Christian Carl's next book. Is there another year since then? We've just had this horrible typhoon in the Philippines that raises all kinds of concerns about climate change, terrorism threats, the impacts of globalization, which you just mentioned. Are we in the process of making another monumental shift here, or is this 1979 going to hold us for a while?
Well, I don't know. That's something I've thought about a lot, Bob. You know, one of the interesting questions in my book is the role of generations, because you can say that the end of the 1970s is really about a good generation away from the end of the Second World War. We are now about, I would argue, about a generation away from the end of the 1970s. And I see a lot of things changing, maybe not as dramatically as they did in 1979. But if 1979 teaches us anything, it's that the most dramatic changes aren't always the most obvious ones. The Islamic Revolution in Iran was a very dramatic, obvious change. But probably the most momentous change of 1979 was the start of economic reforms in China. And at the time, those reforms started off fairly modestly, and the outside world didn't really pick up on them for quite a while. So that's an important thing to think about. It may be that the most fundamental changes that are going on right now are not the ones that necessarily occur to us. Yeah, that's an excellent question. I wonder how we will look back on this year we're in now and how we will assess it as a force for change in the future.
Well, we'll keep an eye on the bookshelf and see what comes about, but we might even see Christian Carl's name on it again. Who knows? Christian, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, the title of your book, Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Next week, Stephen Bechtel, author of Mr. Hornaday's War, How a Peculiar Victorian Zookeeper Waged a Lonely Crusade for Wildlife That Changed the World. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.